Today is June 30th, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I'm interviewing Philip Dunnigan. Our topic is Lou Tate, and we are at the Little Loom House in Kenwood Hill, Louisville, Kentucky. As we begin, Philip, first about you.
About me? Well, my name is Phil Dunnigan. I'm 33. I work at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Civil Division. I was born in Fort Knox and raised in Louisville. I can't think of much else right at the moment. What else do you want to know?
No, that's great. That's perfect. Tell me when you first met Lou Tate.
Well, the year, I'd have to backtrack, but I believe it was when I was in the second grade, because I recall I was in Mrs. Strong's class in the second grade, and I would have been approximately 8 years old, probably. Yeah, at least that's the first time I recall being involved with Lou Tate as far as weaving was concerned. And I remember she had us do a project where you made a loom out of a piece of cardboard. You cut slots on both sides and you made your own little warp. And then you would thread, yarn through it and make it, I think it turned into a, not a pot holder, but something to set drinks on, it's a coaster type thing. And I remember I even took it to school as a show and tell project. And I also remember at that time that I just happened to start just at the time that the Courier Journal did a spread on Lou Tate in the magazine section, and she brought a bunch of little ones down to the studio for photographs, and I happened to be one of the ones included. And as I recall, I had my little cardboard loom with me then, weaving. My little feet wouldn't even touch the floor. They were dangling off the edge of the chair. But yeah, I would say it's about when I was 8 years old.
Now, you live near Lou Tate.
Well, originally, we lived on Earl Avenue. And our friends, the Tennies, lived on, I believe it was South First Street. And then they moved up to the house, the Hill House, or, well, actually, it was the, I guess you'd call it the Hill House. It was at the top of the hill here, Possum Path and Coon Trail. And their home was very much like my second home. I spent, well, almost every weekend there. And because that's just up the road from the where we're sitting at the moment at the top house, I spent a lot of time around here, yeah.
Your mother moved over here after the Tennies moved here?
Right. Mom moved over here, I guess I was in the seventh grade, I'd say around 65. We moved to Orchard Hill Drive, which is on the hill but sort of at the bottom, around on the other side. Orchard Hill next to West Hall and so on.
But you started coming up here before that?
Oh yeah, much before that.
How did you all find out about Lou Tate?
Actually, Mom found out about Lou Tate through the Tennies, and I don't know how the Tennies found out about Lou Tate, because I knew they knew Lou before they moved up here. This probably sounds like I'm choosing these words for the interview, but you think about this place, not so much now with all the construction around here, but when we first came up here, I mean, really the only houses up here were the house at the top of the hill, the Loom House, the LaDan's house further down, and all the construction or new houses were on the other side of the hill. This was all trees. And so I was going to use the term, it was like a haven. I mean, it was like this little area nestled in, you know, urban Louisville that was reasonably untouched. And I remember when the Tennies bought the house at the top of the hill up there on Possum Path, even after we would visit up there, only then did some of these trees down here start coming down, and Kenwood Hill was extended beyond the Loom House and so on. And I guess where I was headed with all that was that we enjoyed coming up here. It was like a special place to come. You know, I liked spending time here. The wind whistling through the trees, and it was just so such rest. It was restful. That's what it was. Restful.
Would you come here for lessons?
Mm-hmm.
Would you come here to visit?
Well, as a matter of fact, as I was saying to you a few minutes ago, just before I came here for this interview, I called my mother to again reminisce about Lou Tate to see if there were things that I had not thought of. And she managed to come out with a letter that Lou wrote her about having a picnic up here for the International Club and the apparently there was some they were having a United Nations Day or something, and Mother was involved in the international club, and so she wrote Mom a letter about inviting some friends up here for a picnic. And in that same letter talked about if I was still keen on the idea of weaving, that I could start on Saturday mornings, that we started promptly at 10, that it would cost me 25 cents. So apparently I'd been here from the letter. I'd been here like one time prior. It would cost me 25 cents for the materials to finish the runner that I was working on, and that my tuition would be $3, which was half the adult rate, and that sometimes she did not charge $3 if I didn't use, wouldn't charge the $3 if one didn't use a lot of materials, or if she had us working on what she termed in the letter an experimental project. And yeah, I came up here, I can't tell you now in my memory just exactly how long, but for over a period of years, a couple of years at least, I was here pretty regularly on Saturdays weaving placemats or she would sometimes call them runners. Of course, they were longer to go over like dressers, like the one behind you there, or coasters, or some belts. And I took lessons.
Would this be on a Saturday with other students?
Oh yeah.
People?
Yeah. Well, this was as part of the fun was there'd be a lot of people here. And in fact, this is one of the things I wanted to mention. I don't know what order to go in, but since we're already on this. You'd come and you'd spend most of the Saturday here, and I'd say around 2 or 4 o'clock, if you'd been good all day, and if you'd been doing what you were supposed to do, Lou would have a big treat for you. She'd pile everybody, in fact, you were supposed to bring a nickel with you, and she'd pile everybody in her Ford station wagon, along with her Cocker Spaniel Skipper, who always sat in the front seat, and he was one of these really happy dogs, you know, tail wagging all the time, ears dangling down. And we would all pile in the back, and we would go down to what I believe was called Haywood Dairy, which was down on Taylor Boulevard, and we would all get an ice cream cone. This was the big thing. And there was always a group of us. I mean, it was like a social set. You know, you would see often many of the same people, sometimes new people, but the kids that lived here on the hill, Ellen Tinney, prior to living here on the hill and after she did, Missy LaDan, when she was living here, Debbie DeLong, who lived back on Lost Trail on the other side of the hill, they were pretty much regulars, and there were several other regulars and some guys, Nookie Hollis, who used to live over here in the house next door. Trying to remember that I think it was Tyrone, I forget, but a couple of brothers. And we'd come up here and we'd weave and we'd go play. You know, it was just a regular event, you know, for us about every weekend.
How did she teach you all?
How did she teach us? Well, I didn't think about that before the interview. I thought about what she taught us. How did she teach us? She taught us patiently. She'd sit down. She'd show us. She would explain it to us. Probably the niftiest thing about Lou was that she treated you like an adult. And if you acted like an adult, she'd treat you like one. She treated you with respect. She treated you like you were worth something and that you weren't just a little kid to be pushed aside, and she was patient, and she would expect things from you. She'd expect you to listen. She would expect you to pay attention. She'd expect you to try. It was like a respect situation. In fact, the term that I coined before I came here, and it sounded corny, but it was true. She not only taught us value, the color. Color values, if you will, as she would call it, the different values and colors. But she taught values in life, if you will. I mean, it was a give and take situation. I remember particularly, and I'm kind of digressing from the question you asked me, but I remember particularly one night when Ellen Tinney was here and I was still young. It was not maybe a year after I'd been here, I seem to recall, because I remember I was young and Ellen was young, and Ellen was down here working on a project. Well, let's see, by that time she must have moved up here to the house, so it wasn't long after that. And she was down here working on a project, and I was with her. In fact, we were in the top house here. And, I don't know, Ellen and I, she was like the sister I never had, and we got into a kind of a brother-sister type argument. And she was a couple years older than I was, well, a year and 6 months, something older than I was. And I remember got really angry. I thought she was being terribly unfair. Of course, I had a temper then. And I think I hit her on the arm, punched her on the arm, made her cry. And Tate heard all this, came upstairs, and I was going to storm off to the house. I was going to storm off to my second home up at the house, going back up the hill here. And I remember I was standing out there, and Tate was down by the what I would call the front door of the top house, and she told me to come back. And I said, no. You know, I was having a tantrum, if you will, crying, upset. And she told me, and I knew she meant. She said if I didn't come back, that I could never come back again. And I had to apologize. And that she just wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior around here. And I mean, that went through me like a knife because I couldn't stand the idea of not being able to come back here anymore. And I knew she meant it just as sure as anything. And so I thought about it a minute, and then remorse started setting in because I hadn't wanted it to happen anyway, and I was really sorry. So I remember I came down and I cried, and I told her I was sorry, and she said that was fine, but I needed to tell Ellen that I was sorry. And I went up and I told Alan that I really didn't mean it, and I was sorry. Of course, I was still kind of mad, too, because I didn't think it was fair, but at the same time, you know, and I told her I loved her, and we patched it all up. And, I mean, I still remember that to this day, because there was a certain definiteness. There was a limit beyond which she wouldn't let you push her, and it gave us, looking at it now, it was like it gave us parameters. There was a stability there, you know. And I don't know if that answers the question, me going off, but I remember that's a story I wanted to tell about Lou. She's special. Anyway.
What kinds of things would she tell stories while she taught you all about leaving?
Yeah, she would tell stories. And Lou was a storyteller. The thing is that as I sit here, I know that that's true, but I can't pick out a specific story. I remember she used to talk about, we used to go up on the what was called Devil's Backbone. As I understand it, it's pretty much all been built over now, constructed. But it was here on the back of the hill. And in fact, there's a photograph out here. It was full of rocks, and they used to call it Devil's Backbone. And we would go, you know, exploring. We'd go up to the top of the hill, and there was a trail at the top of the hill that went to the edge of the backbone. And then we'd go around in the rocks, and we'd come back down. And there were some rocks up there that I'm sure don't exist anymore because I've driven up there, and they were all very flat and set in the ground next to one another, almost in a square or a rectangular shape. Lou would tell us about how the buffalo used to roam in this area back when the settlers came, and that the theory was that those rocks were put there by the Indians in order to stretch out the buffalo hides. And she would tell us, she would try to relate to us the history of the area, the heritage. I mean, Lou was very much, of course this is so pat, but I mean, she was very much on heritage about remembering from when she came. And of course part of that fit into the weaving. Even though I was never what I would call an advanced weaving student, because I sort of, as I grew older, it wasn't the thing for a boy to do anymore. At least I didn't think it was. I'm not sure that that's accurate, but you get into that psyche, that thought process. But Lou always taught me an appreciation for crafts and the art of weaving. And where I was going was that I found out later, as I was older, after I wasn't really actively weaving anymore, that obviously she kept such a tremendous record of all the patterns in her coverlets and so forth. But I mean, that's just Lou. I mean, she was very much into heritage, and she would try and tell us about that, about where things came from and why it was so and how it used to be and what they used to do. And sometimes it would sink in. I mean, like for me, hearing about Indian stretching buffalo skins is one that I still remember, probably sunk in more as a boy. And I'm sure she told me other stories that didn't sink in about the way, you know, why people spun coverlets the way they did or how they came by and sold them or so on. But, yeah, she would tell us stories.
Looking back, do you think that she related especially well to children as compared with adults?
Yeah, there's no question about that. Again, if for no other reason than the fact that Lou treated you like you were an equal, as long as you acted like one. And a lot of other adults would never do that. They'd treat you like a child, and usually you'd respond like a child. And Lou, on the other hand, I mean, she had patience. I mean, not that she didn't have a temper, but it's not one that would ever be shown towards the kids. It was shown more towards the people that were trying to destroy the hill after, you know, over the years by changing the contour face and changing the water runoff and plowing down bulldozing down the property stake lines. I mean, she was in a constant struggle. In fact, it wore her down tremendously, in my opinion, because she was in a constant struggle with the developers who had no appreciation for the same types of things that Lou appreciated. And, you know, I mean, it's progress, but their tactics were less than savory. And but in terms of her temper towards the kids, she was always patient, but she told it like it was. I mean, the incident I told you about not coming back, I mean, it wasn't one of these situations where she would make idle threats and not keep them. Lou was solid. That's what Lou was. Lou was solid.
How did you know about you were young. How did you know about the problem she was having with the neighborhood?
Well, I mean, it was a constant thing maybe the first couple of years I got here, it wasn't so constant. But it was something that you would hear her talk about, if not as a main course, it was a constant byproduct in the conversation. And as the years went on, it got even more so because it threatened the very existence of this area. I mean, first of all, taking it in stages, I'm pointing, you can't see it on the tape recorder, but as they extended Kenwood Hill out and they built the homes, which would be down at the bottom of Kenwood Hill, connecting in with Coon Trail, heading on down towards Carroll Road. I mean, they started bulldozing all these trees out. It is my remembrance, although I don't remember who did it, but that somebody had the bad judgment of taking the trees and putting them together in a pile and then bulldozing dirt on top of them and then building foundations on them so that later all those houses developed tremendous difficulties because as the trees underneath decayed, of course, the foundations themselves would be huge cracks. If I'm not mistaken, they even built one house over here right in the middle of a natural water runoff. I mean, it was all grassy area, but after a rain, it was such that you could set your foot down. I mean, you couldn't tell it was a stream because there was grass there, but after a rain, it was like the water was up to the top of the grass level. Going through, you could set your foot down, and I mean, it would go down over the tops of your shoes, and they built a house right in the way of that. And that was indicative of the lack of respect for the natural aspect of the land. And it got to the point where they were developing here above Possum Path so that they changed the runoff so that there were continual slides, mudslides coming down, and in the later years even blocking Possum Path so that it was impassable, and coming down onto Lou's property and threatening the houses that were here. And I mean, what I'm saying is I was in my earliest stages being around here when I was actively participating in weaving lessons, it probably wasn't quite as apparent. But even when I would come back here, because I mean, Lou became a family friend, even if I wasn't actively participating in the weaving, but just participating in the atmosphere, the ambiance of the place when they would have an open house or so forth, I mean, it was a topic that always came up because it was so continual, you know. And I happen to know that, I mean, I know the Tennies once had trouble there was an instance, a time period where the people who were developing around their house continued to bulldoze over the property stakes, and Hal would have to keep going down there and pounding them back in to make sure that they understood where they couldn't cross. And this happened on this side down here, on the backside, I guess you'd call it, of the property line that Lou had this problem here. And then later, as I was older, I didn't do it that much, but Maury Reedman, who used to live across the street here on Kenwood Hill, he would come up here and drive, they would get railroad ties, and then they would drive stakes in the ground to try and hold the earth from sliding in on the top house up here. And I came up here a couple of times to try and help out. And so it was a continual and a constant problem.
What were your impressions of her as a young child compared with your impressions of her as you became older?
When I was younger and knew her, she was probably more lively and vivacious. Of course, she was younger then too. As she got older, I think that the constant struggle to preserve this place wore her down. But you could still, I mean, even then, you could still see the mirth in her eyes. I recall one Christmas where we were at the Tennies when they still lived in their log cabin. And she made and I have to believe this was after 75, because I believe I was married, but if not, it was certainly after I was in college, and I believe already in law school. She made this little item out of yarn. I can't even tell you how it worked exactly, but she twisted it up, you know, made it twist up, and then she pulled it some certain way, and all of a sudden it just kind of like a rubber band unwound one yarn on top of the other. It was like green and white, and it was like a little Christmas necklace, if you will, that kind of draped around my neck. I remember I wore it to church that night at the midnight service, and of course Lou couldn't go with us, but I remember when she did that, you know, that the term I was using, you could just see that in her eyes there was still that mirth, almost that mischievous spark in her eye. She was a loving person. She was loving the whole time. But again, you know, I think it got to her after a while. And as I was older, I noticed it more. I've already said it. I guess I can't think of much else. Other than the fact that it seemed to become a larger part of me. Again, when I was younger, maybe it was because I was younger, didn't notice as much. But as the struggle became greater, as the struggle towards trying to keep the hill from sliding down on top of the cabins became greater, it seemed to occupy more and more of her being, and would preoccupy her, as opposed to when I was younger, she would seem to be more carefree, I don't want to say defensive, because that's not exactly it, or protective, but it's like she was more outgoing, because she was giving to the world more then, and then as she had to defend, it's like she still did that with the people she knew, but she couldn't reach out as much to spread the weaving and the preservation of culture as she had before, because she was having to spend more time defending. There were lawsuits regarding the property lines. I mentioned to you earlier that I called Mom. She read me a second letter, which was dated in 75. And Lou, you could just tell from the tone of the letter that Lou was talking about how she wasn't really feeling all that well, and she talked about how she wasn't going to be able to make it to my wedding, but she wanted to have a bang-up picnic for me later that summer. And this was a letter to my mom. And then she was talking about the lawsuits, how they were still in the process. This was in 75, so I guess it must have been earlier in 75, because her wedding was scheduled in May. How it looked like we were going to, the way she put it was that the cabins were going to be on the National Register, historic landmark, and that it would be the first such building in the South End, so designated. And she even made mention of the fact that they wanted all three cabins, and that if she gave them all three, that she might go down to Texas. Apparently there was a doctor in Texas who wanted her to move down there, I presume for weaving and so forth, I don't know. But I think her comment in the letter, as Mom read it to me over the phone, was is that if I give them all three cabins, there won't be much point in staying. And that then she made reference to Mother about the fact that Judge Revelle, that they had won the lawsuit on all points, and that Judge Revelle did not have much... this was in her letter, that Judge Revelle did not have much patience, I believe it was, or didn't care much for people who bought undeveloped tracts of land that already had our cabin standing on them, and that Judge Revelle didn't have much respect for a surveyor who, according to her letter, was bought, and that he decided all the issues in their favor. And basically that she wanted to, looking forward to seeing Mom and so on. It's a... I believe Mom showed you a number of letters when my mother had an interview with you, but she said that these two letters she hadn't found and that she hadn't didn't have those out at the time. But I guess that covers it.
Tell me more about Skipper, the dog.
Well, I'd love to. He was Lou's constant companion for years, and he was... In fact, I was thinking about this on the way over here. They say sometimes that people have a tendency to either look like their dogs, or dogs take on the characteristics of the people. When I was younger, when I was telling you about, we used to pile in the Chevy to go to the dairy to get the ice cream. He was, I mean, he was just one of these Cocker Spaniels. He was just excitement from the tip of his nose to his tail. And his tail was just going like this all the time. In fact, his little hind end would even go along with it, you know. And he was just happy. He was just happy. His tongue was out, and he was just happy all the time. And he, I remember Lou used to teach him a trick. Oh, well, he would get ice cream. He loved ice cream. He, Skipper, got his own ice cream cone. When we go down in the Chevy, I mean, that was part of the big deal. He knew. She'd say, you know, go get ice cream, go get ice cream. And he would go run, jump in the car in the front seat. He was there before any of us. And that's because he got his own ice cream cone. He just absolutely loved it. And I remember another thing is she always taught him this trick where she would balance a tiny little twig or stick on the end of his nose, and then he would throw it up in the air, or tilt his head back so it would go up in the air, and then he'd catch it in his mouth. And that was a just a little aside, fun little thing. But he was your constant companion. And of course, yeah, I'm reminded when I think of Skipper of the sad thing too, and that is that he finally passed away. I think he was 13 or 14. And I was in high school, and I remember, I think it was a Sunday afternoon, I think he might have passed away on a Saturday night. I came over here on a Sunday afternoon, and I buried him for Lou. And it was a sad time. It was a sad time. And to my knowledge, she didn't have another after that, because there wasn't another Skipper, you know. And in fact, I think people tried to encourage her to do it. And I don't know, I think maybe she felt she was beyond, you know, going through the process of raising another puppy and so forth. But yeah, I remember we buried Skipper at, actually I buried him, she went inside, I didn't really want her to have to go through that, but at the time, there was a big mound of earth next to the garage, down by the bottom house. I think they now call it the Esta house, and maybe it was called that previously, but I knew it as the bottom house. And there was this big mound of earth, and I think part of that, the purpose of that mound of earth was keep cars from backing up over the edge of where that flat space was for the drive, and also that they used it, or I got the feeling that they must have later used it to also help fill in when the, you know, there would be ruts in the drive and so forth. But there was this huge mound of earth that had been there for a while, and you know, we discussed where she wanted him buried, and she wanted him buried in there, and so I dug a hole and we buried him in there. And I thought for a while, I mean, it was good, because it was almost like there's this mound to symbolize, you know, Skipper. But I don't know how long it stayed there. I noticed when I was coming up here, it's not there anymore, so I don't know what happened to it. But
we have a picture of you here as a little boy weaving next to a piece you wove.
Yeah, this is obviously, you must have taken this on Mother's couch here. I see this. Yes, indeed. That's me with a burr haircut there. Very popular in those days. Although in this, I do not seem to have my lederhosen on. And I always came up here, I had lederhosen on all the time when I came up here. It was just, you know, take light that nobody teased me about it. And they wore so well. Mom always enjoyed sending me up here. Well, that's something. Is that I told you we used to play. I was just thinking about the lederhosen. At the top of Possum Path here, there used to be a tree that had a cable on it. And we always, not that this is any big deal, but we would always play, and it was very rough on one's clothes, and that's why Mom always enjoyed me having the lederhosen on, is because mine would go from week to week to week, and I'd manage to come back. In fact, the story about the lederhosen was that the dirtier they got, the better off they were. It made them better instead of worse, and that we always used to joke, Tate, too, is that the idea was that they were supposed to get so dirty that they could stand up by themselves in a corner. And she would laugh about that. But yeah, this piece, obviously Mom's kept it. This is something else you were asking me about, how Tate taught us. It's got on here a tag, and it was always a big achievement. I mean, it gave you a big sense of pride. Even if you didn't keep the pieces, was that it was always, if you did a piece and it was finished, you ended up finishing a piece, and they would take it to the ladies who were in the senior weavers to stitch, I guess hem would be the proper term, to finish the piece after you'd done all the weaving. They would always take a label and type on the label. I think it was printed, hand-woven by, and then they would type your name on it, and then they would always iron it onto the piece. And so, I mean, I remember feeling pride of accomplishment that this might be sold to someone, you know, at some arts and crafts fair or something. that someone might come up here and buy it, and then on it was going to say, hand-woven by, you know, Philip Dunnigan. And that was the same of every kid here. And it was a means of, again, it was a function. We were talking earlier about making you feel like you were worth something. I mean, it made you feel like you'd accomplished something. And it was good. It was really good. Yes. Anyway, I'm just having fond memories here.
And this is the end of side one, interview one. This is the beginning of Side 2, Interview 1 with Philip Dunnigan.
Oh, while you were changing the tape, I thought of something else. You asked me earlier about how she used to teach us. And I was telling you about the fact that she would always give us certain parameters beyond which we couldn't cross. And I believe I mentioned, perhaps I didn't, but it's come to me now, was the fact that she used to run the place. I mean, you were allowed to be innovative, and you could, and she wanted you to be artistic and imaginative in terms of putting new colors together and so on. But in terms of your behavior, I mean, we were here to learn how to weave, and she would run this place. You know, there was iron rule. I mean, beyond a certain point, there was no disruption. You know, because in essence, and she would explain to us, now that I recall, I remember once we were out here on the gravel, and that was as if we're being too loud and we're playing and having too much fun with each other, we're keeping the other kids from being able to concentrate on what it is that they were doing. And, of course, you hear it, you've heard it before. I mean, I heard it in school and so forth, but I don't know, maybe again, because of the fact that she treated you with respect, or she treated you with this mutuality, it's like when she said it, she wasn't just saying it because it was a reason to get you to stop doing what you were doing, but because it was a real reason why you shouldn't, you know, play. If you wanted to make a lot of noise and play, you could go up on the hill or go someplace else. But here, you know, we wanted to have fun. We wanted to have a good time. We wanted to enjoy ourselves. We wanted to learn. We wanted to create. But we didn't want to be disruptive or silly or so on. And, I mean, there was just a certain point beyond which you didn't go. We're still talking about the way that she used to teach us. And I guess the best thing to do would be to just try and remember how. I mean, I'll just try and create in my mind a series of how this used to go. If you would come up here, you would get a loom, depending on where you were in terms of complexity. She would have different children. All right, let's say you started a piece. First thing you would do is you would go to these little, not boxes, but every... I'll just use the term boxes, would have different spools of yarn in them. And you, part of the whole process was first you had to decide what you were going to do and then how much it was going to take to do that, all of which she would force you to think through but do it with you. Then she would take you over and you went over and you chose which colors you were going to use to put together for which portion of the piece. And then you would come up and hold the colors against one another. That's when I was talking about the value of colors before, because she would talk about color values, you know, and you would hold them next to one another and see whether or not you thought they were going to match. And then you'd take them to Lou and say, Lou, is this going to be all right? And she'd say, sometimes she would say yes or no, but most of the time she would leave it up to your judgment. Well, if you want to do this, then this, and if you want to do that, then that. And you'd end up making the final decision. I mean, it was your own project. Then you would go, and she would sometimes show you how to get started. And then once she got you started, she would stay there with you at the beginning, and she would help you. She would show you if you were pulling it too tight in between when you would beat it, and so that you're making the edges too tight or too loose, and of course the petal exchange and so forth. And she would make sure that you had it, you know, as you pass it through, change the petal, beat it, pass it through and so on, and make sure that you had it down and that you knew what you were doing. If you had a multicolored situation where you're doing more than one shuttle. She would show you how to do that and let you go for a little while, stay with you, make sure you were doing it. And then she would let you go on your own. And she would, of course, you could always stop what you were doing and go ask questions, or you could ask another weaver who was more advanced, or she would pass by and check on you periodically. Like in the, I don't want to say later times, but often it was like in here in the loom house, and then later one of the favorite things would be to weave outside in front of the top house, you know, again with the wind in the trees, and you're outside and it's pleasant, and you're weaving changing and beating, and it was good. And I was remembering that also sometimes she would let some of the other children, I guess if you will, who were more advanced, help you or show you what to do. And then of course a big thing was when you got to the point where you were advanced enough where you could show someone else. And I was just thinking about how it would again make you feel importance and worth it, is like when she would have people come through touring, and she would let you as a 8 or 9 or 10 year old explain to these people what it was you were doing and how you were doing it, why you were beating, and what happened when you did the pedal exchange again, and how you had to keep it even on the sides, and if you pull too tight, and so on and so forth. And of course, here you are explaining to some adult about weaving, and it made you feel, you know, very important. And of course, she would take such pride in that, the fact that you were doing it, and that you cared about it, and that you cared about something that she cared about, and that there you were, talking with authority about weaving, to explaining it to someone else, and it was good. It was good.
As you said earlier, she also became a family friend.
Very much so. Very much so. I love flute. There's no other way to do it, and no other way to say it. I loved her, and she was such a... Well, this leads me to several thoughts. One is that we're very affectionate, and she... Well, here are the thoughts. One is that she was this independent woman. She was, I used the term iron hand before, she had an iron will, because she wouldn't let people, you know, bulldoze her stakes down and try and encroach on her property, and she fought continually. I mean, she gave her life to this. She gave her life to this place. She gave her life to this concept. It was literally her life, and she fought for it. And she was this independent woman. And that's one image. And then the other image is this woman who was so loving. I told you the story earlier about when I was having a tantrum and she set certain parameters. And one of the things I left out was that when she told me that if I didn't apologize, I couldn't come back, and the remorse started to set in, that when I came back down the hill, I remember I was crying, and I put my arms around her waist, and I was crying and saying how sorry I was. And that's when she told me not to, you know, that was fine. Something to the effect of, you know, but that you just can't act this way, you know, that you have to, in essence, letting me know what was expected of me, and that I needed to, in terms of behavior in general, and then, of course, that I needed to go up and apologize to Ellen. But, I mean, like, when I would see her, we would always hug, and I mean, it was like she was an aunt, if you will. My mother's from Germany, and, of course, my father died when I was 3, and in Germany, even people who are not actually blood relatives, I mean, it's a sign of respect. You call them aunt. I did not really call her Aunt Tate, because everybody called her Tate or Lou. That's just how it was. In fact, I was here several years before I realized her last name was Bausman. I always thought her name was Lou Tate. But still, I mean, she was like a part of the family that we would see at certain times of the year, like during Christmas celebration, back when she was feeling better, before she started having a hard time getting around. She would go up to the tennies. And I know I'm digressing away from Lou, but it was sort of part of the ambiance of this area for a time period. When the tennies lived up at this log cabin, which was, again, as I say, just up the hill from these 3 cabins, they used to be involved with the youth group at church, and we used to have some just tremendous times, and Tate would come in and partake in them. I remember we used to, when it would snow, we would have these tremendous sledding parties where they would put like hurricane torch lamps down the hill a certain distance, and we would sled from the top of the hill, from the top of where Possum Path and Coon Trail intersected, all the way down Coon Trail, turn onto to a portion of Kenwood Hill Road and then down until we got to Carroll Road. And sometimes if you had a really good one, you would go across Kenwood Road down here, down toward as far down as Esplanade, where Esplanade was down there, and then you'd have to, of course, walk all the way back. But if you had a really good run, that's how far you'd go. And we'd do this like after a snow fell. It would be, I want to say the middle of the night, but like if it was on a weekend, it would go late into the night, of course, because you didn't want to have to worry about the traffic problems. And my point is that Lou would be up here, and she'd just be a part of it all. You know, they'd have warm cider and just tremendous fellowship, and Lou would be up laughing and telling stories and just, I mean, she was just a very loving, caring person, and she was like part of the Tenney's family, and the Tenney's were like our family. I mean, the Tenney's were like my second parents. And so, yeah, I mean, I considered her a family member. No question about it. Loved her very much, as did my mother. And, well, and the fact that Lou, of course, Lou was very much on corresponding by mail, but Mom has, as you're already aware from your previous oral history, but Mom has lots of letters from Lou. And I used to have some. I don't think I have them anymore. You know, where Lou would talk about her trips where she'd gone to Canada or talk about her weaving or so on and so forth. And, I mean, there's the love aspect. And yet, on the other hand, and I want to touch on this, is there's this strong, independent woman who, as I said, fought the fight to save this place. Also independent in the sense that they always wanted Lou to, or she took it to be compromise. She was not much on compromising what she believed in. And she had strong beliefs. Not that she wasn't tolerant, mind you, but when she came to a firm conviction about something, arguing with her was just a roundabout process, because if her mind was set, that was pretty much it as far as she was concerned. And she had a certain idea about how weaving should be taught and how, you know, what the purpose of all this was and what the byproduct of all this should be as well, in addition to just the weaving itself. And I remember that, not that I was directly involved in this, but numerous times would it come up in conversation with people who were involved with the Loom House that Lou had been approached about integrating her program with the public school system. And she resisted it continually because she was afraid that this place would lose its identity and that it would be swallowed up and that the program wouldn't be run properly because of the hugeness of integrating with something like that. And it isn't it's not that she might not have been willing to, but only on certain terms which she could live with, and not, she just couldn't compromise certain things that were too important to her, because again, they were her life. I mean, she lived to further this way of life, to pass it on to people, and she didn't want it to be compromised. Okay, in another vein, something I thought of was that, I guess the ambiance is a story that event that came to mind was that in the winter months, Ellen Tenney, who again used to live in the house in the log cabin up here, was like my sister, and she was working on a project, I believe, for her mother, or to give to her mother. And it was, I believe the right term was a serape, but it was this, it was like a shawl, and it was multicolored, and it was a major project that took hours and hours of weaving, because it was quite a lengthy piece, and it had to be just right, and there were so many different colors to coordinate, and the warp, in fact, I recall she had to warp another loom in order to finish the project and so forth, and I was just reminded of how it was here. Tate would heat these houses with stoves, and I remember once we were up here at the top house, and Ellen was working at night, and I believe I was down here because I didn't want her to have to walk back alone from here up to the top house, and she was working, weaving, and it was cold, and I recall that in order to work, you had to be very close to the stove. I mean, it was like there was this little radius of warmth, this pocket of warmth, and then everything else around it was cold. In fact, we're sitting in the top house now, and it's so different. Of course, it's much more airy now and open, and before there used to be looms stacked up on the walls and yarn all over the place. And the stove that is there now is not the same stove that used to be here. And I remember Ellen would be near it with her loom set up and weaving. And if you went outside this door here, we have this glass door out to the stone surrounding or the stone porch inside the building yet, but it would be very cold. You could see your breath. If you went downstairs, you could see your breath. It was this ambiance. It was like this pocket of warmth, and you'd be working huddled over your loom. And of course, Tate would do this oftentimes too. She'd be up here working at various hours, again, in this pocket of warmth. And outside it was cold, but in and around the stove it was warm. And as an aside, it was also often that way down at the bottom house, was that there were certain, the fireplace, you know, when the fire was going, it would be warm around the fireplace. Where the stoves were, it was warm. Elsewhere, it was cooler as you got further from the perimeter, even in the same room. And it was not exactly the same, but it was like the stories you're told about in the old cabins, where the only place that was of warmth was around the fireplace, and if you were elsewhere in the cabin, you were in a place there where the temperature was going to be lower. And so it wasn't unusual to wear sweaters. In some ways it was like Europe. They warm certain places, and every place else in the house is cooler, and that's, you wear a sweater and you take it off when you're in the warm area. And it was much the same in Tate's place. That was the one thing in terms of the ambiance. And then another thing that came to mind was you were asking me about my family relationship with Tate. And I thought of a few things since then. One was that, and I've always really felt, warmth towards Tate for introducing me to this, but Tate was an avid reader. In the bottom house, there were books everywhere, and she read constantly. I don't think she ever had a television set, to my knowledge. She had a radio, I believe. But she would read constantly. And she introduced me to The Hobbit, which, of course, in turn introduced me to the Trilogy of the Rings. And, of course, for me, at that time, I believe it was high school, it was a fantasy world, but it was so fascinating. And Tate would encourage you to... it wasn't just weaving. I mean, she encouraged knowledge. She encouraged learning. She encouraged... I always use reaching out beyond just the area in which you knew. And this was one area I remember she encouraged me to read the book. We were down there for some social engagement, social visit. I think the Tennies and my mom. And I think Ellen was there. I'm not sure. Ellen may have been gone to college by that time because she was like 1 or 2 years ahead of me. And Tate, it could have been one of her chili suppers, although it wasn't a large gathering, as I recall, in terms of a party. And I was over at the couch next to the window, and she encouraged me to read this book, and I really wasn't that interested necessarily in getting into a book at the time, but she just kept saying, if you start it, you're really going to like it. Just press on for the first few pages, and you'll get hooked. And so, sure enough, it was a casual situation. They were talking. I went over and laid down on this little day bed, I guess is what you'd call it. It was next to the window, and started reading, and after I got through the first pages, I was hooked. I was halfway through the book by the time they were ready. They talked into the evening and were ready to go, and she let me keep it, take it with me. And I don't know, I just always enjoyed that she introduced me to that sort of thing, because that's the way she was. And then other things that came up was that I remember Tate gave me once a present. Or I remember I was in the house at one time, again, an evening, maybe a social occasion, we were having dinner at Tate's, and I saw this old weapon. It turned out that it was an old Smith & Wesson. It was in a holster that had a little mildew on it, actually. The weapon itself was a little bit pitted. It had been a nickeled 38 Smith & Wesson, and it was not loaded. And the only reason she said she had it in the house was because it used to belong to her uncle. As I remember, the story was either uncle or great uncle, but it was a relative of hers who used to carry it when he worked as either a conductor or whatever the proper term is. I don't want to say engineer, but he was on the railroad. And this was back, and he had it because this was back when he rode the railroad. It was back in the days when people weren't very fond of the railroads, and they had a tendency to shoot at people at trains as they passed, and the folks on the trains would arm themselves and they would shoot back. And that's what he'd used this weapon for, was to defend himself when he was on the railroad. And if someone took pot shots at the car or the caboose that he was riding in, as Tate called it, you know, he would pull out the weapon and, you know, aim in the general direction from whence the firing was coming, so in essence to possibly suppress their desire to keep on shooting. And I was always fascinated with it. And so finally, one day as a present, she gave it to me. I can't remember if it was Christmas or birthday, but she just let me have it. And then later we had it re-nickeled, if you will, Mom, as another birthday present. I remember later it was re-nickeled by as a project so that it would not be pitted and would look nicer and so on. And I still have it now. And then the other thing is that when Tate couldn't make it to the wedding, I believe I mentioned earlier that there was that second letter in 75 when she was talking about the lawsuit and so forth, and part of what she said was that she couldn't make it to the wedding and wanted to have a picnic for us. Later in the summer, she however, as a wedding present to my former wife, Karen, and myself, she gave us a partial set of, I believe it's called Limoges china, that had belonged to either her aunt or her great aunt. I believe it was her aunt's. And she just wanted us to have it, you know. And it was like Tate always to give, not like to go out and buy something, I suppose partially because she didn't have the money, but because it was closer to give something that belonged to her, you know, and to pass it on to people that she cared for. And, I mean, I was really honored that she gave me the china. I was really pleased. I mean, I didn't really expect that. It wasn't necessary that she give us anything, and it was nice.
What are you going to remember most about Lou Tate?
Well, I'm just thinking about it now, and I'm remembering Tate right now. And I suppose the first thing that comes to mind is her laugh. I used the term earlier, mirth, the twinkle in her eye when she laughed, how merry she could be when she was being that way. And I translate that also to how loving, I mean, she could be loving, how much I loved her. But I suppose in terms of, other than remembering that she could be that way and what effect that'll have on me, was her principles. And I don't think that's a term I've used up to now, but she had principles and she had things she believed in, and she was, I hate to use it because it sounds negative. I don't mean to be negative when I say this, but she was almost uncompromising in certain things that were important to her. I talked about values. I mean, she taught me certain values. And she didn't just, I guess that's it more than anything, is it's. I look at these three houses, these three cabins, and I realize that they pass away, but she stood for the fact that she took a stand as to what her life was going to be about, and whether it was mighty or small, whether it was in some people's eyes worth something or not, it was worth something to her, and she spent her whole life living that stand, living that idea. And if I would remember most about Lou Tate, it's just the concept that someone decides what's important to them, and then they try to spend the rest of their life living that decision. And I don't know even if she entered into it consciously. I don't know if she said, this is important to me and I'm going to do it. But somewhere along the line that developed. And when it did, she stood by it.